You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media, Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix. On this Wednesday, September the 17th, I'm Heather Vail, here with one of my co-hosts, Jay Amernick. The other one, Rick Raddatz, is actually in Washington right now carrying on some secret meetings that we're going to find out about on next week's show. Jay Amernick, however, is here today. He's the strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. He's the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their businesses into the U.S., and his development labs create smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz, our missing co-host, is a serial entrepreneur, internet marketer, and crazy philosopher. He has a political development that he calls a solution. That solution is to cap and prioritize government spending, which forms the basis of this show. I'm Heather Vail, otherwise known as The Unwrapper. I'm a freelance interviewer and journalist who has worked in all media, TV, radio, print, and online. Jay, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well. I had a very subdued week last week. A lot of it spent here in the office getting some work done, which is, you know.
Wow, that's unusual for you.
It is. It's very unusual for me. The summer is coming to an end, which is a little saddening. It's a little disheartening, I got to tell you. But
the summer seasons of Jay is over.
It really was. I'll tell you, I had a fantastic summer, despite all the nonsense. So.
Cool. So before the show, you started to tell me about Wayne and Schuster. You were trying to crack jokes. Now, well, wait a second. I know that you have written comedy. I know that you are funny, but you were trying to be Wayne and Schuster for some reason, and it was falling flat. What's the deal?
I made a joke, and our producer Doug thought it was hilarious.
You did not.
Moving on. And whenever you don't find something funny that I say, I blame it on your Canadian sense of humor, and I say, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm not Wayne and Schuster." I'm being derisive of Wayne and Schuster. So those of you who don't know, Wayne and Schuster are these two. The Yiddish term is Altacockers. It means like old guys, and they were so, like, to me, it was so. Let me explain to you my. And again, I'll begin the story very. And I'll go through it very quickly. As a 13, 14, 15 year old boy, few things you look forward to other than the Benny Hill show, other than the fact that it was hilarious and the women were incredibly hot.
Hill was hilarious, running around in circles. That was just freaking hilarious. I'm just laughing just thinking about it.
Hot women. Getting back to that.
Okay.
It was on at 11 o'clock at night.
Okay. Just to clarify, people, it's not about the comedy. It's about the hot women.
It was hard enough to stay awake till 11 o'clock at night. I turn on Channel 20 in Washington, D.C. one day, and what is there? At 11 o'clock, Wayne and Schuster, I have to now stay up an extra half an hour with the most boring, and they drew it out, too.
Julie, don't go, but he wouldn't listen.
It was so not funny. And there were no women. It was just these two.
Yes, there was.
Wayne and Schuster? No, there were not.
I told them, Julie, don't go, but he wouldn't listen. The famous...
All Caesar. I knew is I cried for a week having to sit through Wayne and Schuster in order to get to the Benny Hill show and Hill's Angels.
I interviewed Frank Schuster a few times. He was really cool.
Looking back at it now, they're actually funny. But as a 14-year-old boy, I didn't, it was like watching Star Trek as a kid. I didn't care about the cerebral, Gene Roddenberry's interesting vision of the future and humanity and all this. I was like, bring on Lee Merriweather in the skin-tight outfit and Lieutenant Uhura in the short skirt. you know. As we grow older, our priorities change, so.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, so there's actually a lot of comedy that comes out of Canada, not just Wayne and Schuster. I mean, we could fill the whole show just naming Canadian comedians.
No, no, I agree. I have the utmost respect. Dan Aykroyd is one.
Colin Mochrie, Eugene Levy, Mike Myers, yes. Jim Carrey.
Most of the original Second City crowd was Canadian. Yeah. I believe Eugene Levy, as you mentioned, Joe Flaherty, I believe.
Yep. Dave Thomas. Moranis.
Yep. And Second City, that was actually one of my big influences when I wrote
Andrea comics. Martin.
Andrea Martin, another funny one. And
Catherine O'Hara.
John Candy, I don't know if he was Canadian, but he was part of that.
Yes, he is Canadian,
well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or was.
Was Canadian.
Yeah.
He actually owned the Toronto football team at the end there.
Really? Did not know.
Yeah, the Argos. Yeah, he was the owner of the Argos.
And then we mentioned Star Trek, and William Shatner is not
William Shatner? Yeah.
It's not only Canadian, he's actually one of
Leslie Nielsen.
Leslie Nielsen. No, there's no doubt. But Wayne and Schuster was my that was my bone of contention. So I dug. And most people probably don't know who Wayne and Schuster are. Would you agree in America?
Oh, yeah, these days I would say so. 30 years ago, they probably did. Maybe.
Yeah, you know why? Because it interrupted the Benny Hill show, that's why.
Yeah. What about the kids in the hall? That was a little more bizarre, though.
I worked with one of them. Not really worked with him. I was in a casting session. And he auditioned. I can't remember which one it was. Curly hair and glasses.
Oh yeah, Kevin McDonald.
Kevin McDonald. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. He was very funny. He was very good in the audition. I don't think he got it, but he was very good.
He was in a couple of Seinfeld episodes.
He was actually wrong for the role that he was reading for, but he was very funny, and I recognized him immediately.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they actually used to have their production studio in an office building that downtown Toronto, a warehouse studio building that I was helping to run at the time as well. So I got to deal with them actually quite a bit. And the funny thing was their receptionist was Rachel Sutherland. I can't believe I just glitched on the last name, who happens to be Kiefer Sutherland's twin sister.
Oh, interesting. And then daughter of Donald.
And Donald Sutherland's daughter, obviously. Yes. So yeah. And they are all Canadian, Donald Sutherland, Kiefer Sutherland, that whole crew, they're all Canadian too.
I did not know that.
You didn't? How did
you
not know that? How did you not know that?
That he was Canadian?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, he is. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They're all very Canadian.
Very Canadian?
Yeah, I know.
Is there very Canadian or is there sort of Canadian?
No,
I'm somewhat Canadian. I'm slightly Canadian. I'm a tad Canadian. I'm a touch Canadian. I'm just a little bit Canadian and a little bit rock and roll.
I think it depends. Yeah, I think it depends on the genealogy, because if you're half Canadian and half American, like one parent of each, then that makes you half Canadian. But if you're fully Canadian, then you're very Canadian. But you know what?
I wouldn't say someone's very Canadian.
Canadians just infiltrate the states, and you guys like you never even
know.
No, notice.
I get no. If he could, no. Okay, you know, yeah. No, if he, you know, so very Canadian to me would be like if he, you know, walks in like smoking a cigarette with a ski cap on and drinking a Labatt's. You know that. You know.
Okay.
That,
no.
That's
no. No. Okay. First of all, it's Labatt's. Labatt's, not Labatt's. And thank you very much, Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis, for creating that stereotype that Americans actually think is real. Thank you. You have made my life so easy by convincing Americans that I say A all the time, which I do not, that I call people hosers, which I do not, and that I drink beer, which I do not. Thank you.
Say the word O-U-T.
Out.
Yeah, there we go. I'm a big Canada fan. I've been a couple times. The only thing that throws me off are your incredibly weird potato chip flavors.
Like ketchup?
Ugh. And like
dill pickle.
Sardine and
dill pickle.
Dill pickle. Ugh. Ugh. I collapsed in the middle of the
They
store.
Used to have. Yeah. They used
like,
to
oh,
have.
We got an American down on the potato chip aisle, and you know, another one.
When I was a kid, they had cherry, orange, and grape flavored potato chips.
Oh God.
However, I must say, they did not last. They got pulled off the shelves pretty quickly because no one would eat them.
But... Exactly. They capped and prioritized. It wasn't worth their time to make grape-flavored potato chips. Like, God, what kind of diseased mind?
Jesus. Yeah.
I would love to have been a nap. Oh, for God's sakes.
So, all of this is a good lead into the top story. Actually, you know what? I almost want to go with... No... Yeah. I don't know. There's two stories here. I'm not sure which one to go with. But kind of this talk about potato chips kind of reminds me a little bit of the second story. So I think I might start with the second story.
Okay.
All right. This is out of Clearwater, Florida. Clearwater, Florida. They say it's like Florida's version of the blob. Slow-moving glops of toxic algae in the northeast Gulf of Mexico are killing sea turtles, sharks, and fish, and threatening the waters and beaches that fuel the region's economy. Known as red tide, this particular strain called Carinia brevis is present nearly every year off of Florida, but large blooms can be particularly devastating. Right now, the algae is collecting in an area about 60 miles wide and 100 miles long, about 5 to 15 miles off St. Petersburg in the south and stretching north to Florida's Big Bend, where the peninsula ends and the panhandle begins. Fishermen who make a living off the state's northwest coast are reporting fish kills and reddish water. Red tide kills fish, manatees, and other marine life by releasing a toxin that paralyzes their central nervous system. The algae also foul beaches and can be harmful to people who inhale the algae's toxins when the winds blow on shore or by crashing waves, especially people with asthma and other respiratory ailments. In 2005, a strong red tide killed reefs, made beaches stinky, and caused millions in economic damage. A weaker red tide in 2013 killed 276 manatees, if you can believe that, after infecting the grasses eaten by the endangered creatures. Now, despite years of study, there's nothing that anyone has been able to do about it. In the 1950s, wildlife officials tried killing the red tide algae by dumping copper sulfate on it, which made the problem worse in some ways. But some researchers are working to change that. Predicting when tides are going to be especially bad can help fishermen and beach businesses prepare. Right now, a lot of that information comes from satellite images, which are often obscured by clouds. While the project recently received rapid response money from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to send a data-collecting robotic glider into the bloom, future funding for this work is in doubt. NOAA spokesman Ben Sherman said the president's 2015 budget does ask for $6 million in increase for research related to red tide forecasting, including the Gulf of Mexico, but they're still waiting for Congress to approve that. Fishermen are saying that a better warning system could definitely help them save time and money. So kind of a sad story, a devastating story. All this wildlife. You know, all this wildlife being taken over by this killer algae.
Yeah, and it's funny because my first thought, before I heard the entire story was like, well, let's do a little research on it and make sure this is actually a bad thing. Because what if red tide happens to be like, you know, the Soylent Green, the miracle food that'll feed the world? But clearly, you've never seen Soylent Green.
It's made out of people. Why are you bringing this up?
Well, it was the idea that it was the miracle food.
Oh, my God.
That was gave away the ending of the movie.
The whole point was that...
Okay, I understand, and I'm going to tie it into Cap and Prioritize for everybody. Calm down.
Let's do that.
Because Rick will have a fit if he hears this, and I didn't.
So I think this is a priority.
Oh, yes. No doubt.
Yes. Let's prioritize this.
Okay, yeah. I know there's no doubt, but I'm actually going to take it a step further and say once Cap and Prioritize is actually implemented, this won't even be a problem because we will have already stemmed the red tide, if you pardon
the
pun.
How are we going to stem it? They've been studying it since the 1950s, and they haven't
figured
it out.
But not doing – well, no, they apparently – what was the chemical they poured on it? It sounded bad.
Copper sulfate.
That sounds like, no, who would think that would do anything? I'd love to talk to that scientist.
Apparently somebody did.
I'm not a marine biologist, and I can tell you that's a bad idea.
Okay, what about, like, I'm sure they've thought of things like, let's pour chlorine, or let's pour dish detergent, or let's pour, I mean, I'm sure they've come up with the stuff. Let's pour a rubbing alcohol. They must have gone through these thoughts and studied. Well, like, they must have picked up some bits of this and poured different stuff in and saw what killed them or didn't kill them. Apparently nothing killed them, or they would have done it by now.
Well, you do that in a controlled environment, which would be a laboratory.
Right. Yeah, they must have done that by now. Like, they know what.
Well, apparently they didn't, because it made the situation worse. But okay, but the way cap and prioritize actually, once implemented, actually stops this is because it brings much more order to the world. So whatever caused this, do we know what caused the red tide?
It's environmental. It's natural algae.
Oh, well then there's not much we can do about
it. It says it's present nearly every year off of Florida, but sometimes it just blooms especially a lot. So depending on, I'm assuming it's depending on the weather, the environment.
Okay.
They're trying to predict it, so there must be some way that they can predict it.
So then there's the possibility that this falls under the category of natural disaster, ish, right?
Yeah.
Like you can't stop a hurricane, you can't stop a tornado, you can't stop an earthquake, you can't stop a, well, to an extent you can stop a mudslide, but
If they could see the satellite images better, which keep being obscured by clouds, so they can't see the satellite images properly. But if they could, then they would be prepared to deal with it. I don't know how they would deal with it, except maybe just avoid the area for a while.
I think that may be it. I mean, if they tried pouring chemicals on it and that didn't seem to work,
but they tried one chemical. I mean, I'm sure there's other things they could try.
Is there an algicide? I don't know. I'm not a marine biologist. I really don't know.
What about hydrogen peroxide? I mean, like something like that.
In the water? No.
Why? It would probably just end up neutralizing everything. Hydrogen peroxide.
No, because our fish. Do you want to drink it? Do you want to eat the fish that drank it?
I've drank it in small amounts.
Hydrogen
actually
peroxide?
Drink it. Food grade hydrogen peroxide. Yes.
Who's drinking food grade hydrogen?
You don't
Again,
drink
Canadians
it.
Canadians will do anything for a thrill.
No, you put a few drops in water and you drink it, and this is like a health cleanse that you do.
Yeah, until they come out and say.
I must say though that I couldn't. You're supposed to go up to like 25 drops or something. Like each day you add one drop, and this is supposed to take like a month to do this. And then once you get to 25, you start going down. I couldn't get there. Once I hit like 12 drops, I couldn't.
Because
it.
It's bleach.
It's
You're
not
drinking
bleach.
Bleach.
It's not chlorine bleach.
It's one of the most corrosive, acidic. You and I are not going to come up with the correct chemical to destroy red tide on this show today, I got to tell you.
No, we won't.
But I would suggest that they continue looking. So yes, in fact, it would be a priority to figure out if there in fact is a way. Like if there was a way to stop earthquakes, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
But this seems to be a little bit more manageable than the natural disasters that we are.
Well, apparently not, or else in 70 years they would have figured out something.
No, they could be bad scientists.
Okay, but if it's going to kill 300 manatees a year... Yeah, and not every year is that bad. Not every year is that bad. Yes, that's a lot. They're endangered. That's a lot. That's a lot.
It is? You sure?
Yes.
All right. Okay. If you say so. I'll go with you on that.
Okay.
No, I don't know. 300, that could be
like... But that's not every year. That's not every year. That's when it's especially bad. I don't know how many manatees have died this year. I don't think they have a count yet.
My suggestion would be to somehow get the manatees out of that area and possibly just kind of habitat.
Live. That's where they live.
Well, you move them.
Yeah, but if they could naturally live somewhere else, they would be living somewhere else. That's where they live.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
They'd
have to do a lot of study to find out if manatee can live elsewhere first.
They've had 50 years.
But they didn't
came up
that.
With this
they didn't study that part. They didn't study that part. Yeah, 50 years ago, they dumped copper sulfate, and then, oh, now we're done. We're not going to do anything else. Like, what? They must have done other stuff in the meantime.
Yeah, I'm not I'm not wowed with these scientists, quite frankly. I don't think they're curious enough. I don't think they're
It doesn't seem like they're doing a very good job. No, it doesn't. No. I think we should prioritize. So $6 million in a $6 million increase for research in this area, I think would definitely be well spent.
If you say so, again, I don't know if that's a lot of money or a little money for what they're doing.
Well, that's all they're asking for. So if that's all they're asking for, they must know that that's an optimal amount.
Well, or they mean that it means they can get by with $3 million.
Maybe. Yeah. But they need something.
Yeah, give them $6 million. That's nothing.
Okay.
Done.
Sold.
Okay. Beautiful.
All right. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with Jay Amernick. And before the break, we were talking about one of the top stories, which was Red Tide, this blob of toxic algae that's taking over near Clearwater, Florida. And we both decided that as far as cap and prioritizing goes, they need to prioritize and put more research into what can handle this blob that's killing all these fish and all these manatee who are endangered. Jay thinks we should just move the manatee and give them a new place to live, but...
Well, I asked if we could. I don't know.
Well, so again, I guess that's part of...
For the third time in the show, I will say I'm not a marine biologist. I have no idea.
I'm like George. Yeah, okay.
He was an architect, I thought.
But he pretended to be a marine biologist once, remember?
Oh, that's right. With the whale and the golf ball.
The golf ball. Yeah, in the blowhole. Right. Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
All right. So let's have Inside Perspective. This is where Jay Amernick gives us his insider knowledge about the government and the way it works, how politics could be run better. So take it away with Inside Perspective.
Thank you very much. So I had one I was going to do today, and then Rick has these meetings in Washington D.C., so he wasn't going to be here, and I was going to engage him on that. But this is a different one. I'm going to try to tie it into cap and prioritize, and I'll actually maybe even explain cap and prioritize for someone who's listening the first time to the show. So I've been seeing a lot lately about political funding and campaign fundraising and such like that. And I will tell you, it is not the tail wagging the dog. It is not people buying elections as Bernie Sanders suggests. Bernie Sanders is a senator from the state of Vermont and is actually an admitted communist. But never, and he's part of the independent party. So neither party claims him. Yeah, he admits to being he says socialist, but he's a communist. It's the same thing.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely the same thing.
There's degrees. No,
it's the not. The Soviets used the word communism when the West figured out like how horrible it was. They said, "Oh, let's come up with a different term to try to fool them," and they came up with socialism. Anyway, moving on. Bernie Sanders, if the Koch brothers, as he suggests, have bought every election, why haven't they bought his? It doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. He's way off on this. And also to suggest that the way it basically works is let's assume I have a great deal of money and I want to make sure I have a voice in the Congress. Okay, I'm not going to go to some guy who is clearly not on my page. I'm going to like look for a candidate that speaks to me, that has my views. So it's really the other way around. Is the candidates come out there and they say I'm for A, B, and C. And then I say I have money. I'm for A, B, and C. This is my guy. That's how it works. It's not. Nobody's buying elections. All you can do is buy ad time. You can't buy people's votes. You can't buy whether somebody goes to the polls or not and votes. So it's again. And here's how I'm going to tie it into cap and prioritize. Again, cap and prioritize once implemented will make us much more thoughtful, and we will not be, so thrown by these crazy ads that you see, and those are the ones that are, bought by, on the right by the Koch brothers, and then the left by George Soros, which I, by the way, never hear, the people who complain about campaign financing never complain about the amount of money George Soros puts into the mix, which is curious. It's like it's Republicans aren't allowed to do it, but conservatives aren't allowed to do it, but liberals are. Seems to be the double standard there. And next week, don't worry, I'll rag on the conservatives. It'll be fine. It actually will. Yes, I'm looking at next week's topic. But it is not bought and paid for. You still get to vote for whoever you want to vote for.
Okay. However, how do we know that it's not a chicken and egg scenario? You're suggesting that first the candidate comes up with the platform and then people say, oh, yeah, I like that platform too. Here's my money. How do we know?
Yes.
How do we know that it's not people that have money to invest saying, I would like to see a platform that's this, and the candidate saying, oh, that could be my platform?
Okay, Okay, so yes. You get the opportunity to educate and then engage your member of Congress. Absolutely. But anybody can do that.
Okay, so
I'll tell you this. Okay, you can get a member with your member of Congress. Oh, well, you can't because you're...
Yeah, you can't. I can't.
You're a foreigner. I can, okay?
Okay.
Without having getting any money. As a matter of fact, my member of Congress actually returns my emails.
But if you had money and you said, Mr. Member of Congress, I would really appreciate it if you would support XYZ. And he says, you know, Jay, that's a damn good idea. I am going to support XYZ.
It can't be dependent on I'm writing you a check and I want you to do it.
It's such a fine line. How do we know how often that happens?
It's not that much of a fine line because it's easy enough to figure out. Because when candidates are running, they put out a position paper on almost every issue there is. So when they go into office, they know where they are. They're on record. You can go to their website and they have a position paper literally on everything. You can look at their voting record on everything. For them to all of a sudden have a 180 degree turn, people are going to be like, "Oh, wait, what's
that about?" 180. I'm not suggesting 180. I'm suggesting 45 degrees.
I'll give you a great example. There was a senator. He's no longer in office, having nothing to do with this. It was his own actually scandal that he decided not to run again, and in my opinion, wisely, was opposed to foreign aid. Okay, and when I lobbied for foreign aid. That was one of the things I lobbied for. And it didn't matter whether I brought somebody in who said, we'll write you a check for XYZ if you support foreign aid. He wasn't going to support foreign aid, hands down. Thusly, there were people that did not support him. His campaign. Simple as that. They went to his opponent.
Okay. The thing is, some politicians would shift their platform just based on the fact that, I mean, how do we know they're not? I'm not saying they do. I can't sit here and say they do, but how do we know they're not?
How do I put this? Well, one, you're not writing them a check for X amount of dollars. You're writing their campaign a check. So it's not like it's right. So, okay. So how do I explain this it's not worth it for them to get embroiled in changing their position on something. Because by the way, okay. So if you know, Senator, A is opposed to foreign aid, he's got people who are opposed to foreign aid who are funding his campaign. It's where he is ideologically. It's not where he or she is monetarily. I've seen enough of it. It's really the way it works. There, I'm sure there are off cases where there are some guys that can be bought and paid for, but overall, the overwhelming majority is that's how it works. It's the other way around. I stand for A, B, and C, and if you like it, come on board. If you don't like it, I can't help you. Or they will even try to change your mind.
Okay. Now, there are always topics that many people are not firm on. I mean, like, we all have things that we're definite, okay, I'm for this, I'm against this. We also have a lot of gray areas where it's like, you know, I really don't know enough about this to take a side one way or another.
So
how do we know that the politicians are not in the same boat where it's like, you know, something like let's just say foreign aid, because you brought it up. That's just our example.
Okay.
They didn't even consider that. But they are for other things that are kind of in alignment with that. And Mr. Investor says, you know, because this candidate's in alignment with this other stuff, maybe I could convince him that foreign aid is also a good place to focus. And sure. So here's some money if you choose to add this to your platform. How do we know that doesn't happen? And then, okay, so he gives him $5 million towards his campaign. All of a sudden, this guy has...
You can't do that. You can't give somebody five. There are limits.
What's the limit? What's the limit?
I can't remember offhand what it is.
A million. Okay.
So he gives him I don't know what...
Let's say it's a million. So he gives the guy $1 million towards his campaign. Just okay, you're going to add foreign aid to your platform. Love it. Here's $1 million. All of a sudden, the guy is putting.
But then he's going to have guys on the other side say, "We supported you because of this. If you have a change in your platform, we're
no, but it's not a 180 though. It's 45 degrees off what he was already.
Well, keep in mind there are two. Well, foreign aid, it's either a yes or no vote. Just so you know. So there are two currencies when it comes to the world of politics, or I should say in campaigning. One is actual currency because you need money to run, and two are votes. So if I walk into your office, but I don't have any money, and I'm sitting there with 20 people, they have an equation that they work with, and it's literally for every phone call they get, they're assuming that 100 people feel that way. Okay, for every letter they get, they're assuming. I don't know what the equation is offhand, but they literally have that in their head, and they keep a board of where people are on certain issues. So if I am meeting with a member of Congress who is opposed to foreign aid, my first thing is going to be to try to meet with his foreign policy person. Because that's the lens with which the member of Congress is going to see it. Unless the guy is so well up on it and is totally opposed to it and there's nothing you're going to do, then you just move on and just know that that's okay. Going to be a no vote and that's it. And right. You're not going to give him any money and that's and
yeah, no, that wouldn't happen. So what Bernie Sanders is alleging, from what I understand from what you said, is that these are people with a lot of money mm-hmm. who presumably are not trying to go to the person who's against what they want. They're going to the person that's kind of on the fence.
No, they're going to the person that's for what they want already. And again...
I don't know. I mean, why would they not... If someone's already for what they want, why would they waste their time there when they could get another candidate?
Because they want to make sure that individual gets elected again. So they want to support them and make sure they get elected again. But Bernie Sanders is saying all the elections are bought and paid for. We're like, well, then who's buying and paying for his? He's been in Congress in the Senate for a very long time. And
well, he's not leaving himself out of the equation, is he? I mean, everyone runs campaigns.
Of course he is, because he's, yes.
He says that his campaigns are not bought and paid for. Even does he have signs?
No, but he's saying that there's something wrong with it. And then if there's something wrong with it, then he should, and he doesn't like the way it works, then he should bow out and say, I don't like that I'm bought and paid for.
So it's he's silly. Trying to say everyone else is bought and paid for, but not him?
That's the way I'm reading it. It's silly.
Okay.
I just don't get that when somebody says, how can you say that it's not a fair system and then you got elected? So that means that you, right? Or is it unfair everywhere else but Vermont?
Okay, but in reality, if we just take a step back and look at this from a less tainted perspective, look at it more objectively, the fact that the people with a lot of money, and this is going to sound, I'm just saying this objectively, this is not, I'm not being all like left-wing hippy-dippy, but the way that it's coming across is that the people that have the money to pay for campaigns are essentially the ones who are running the campaigns. Because even if they're going to politicians who are already in alignment with what they want, the fact that they're giving them money, therefore that candidate can put out better ads, bigger billboards, more people vote for them just because of the recognition factor, then in essence, that is a campaign that's been bought and paid for, even if there's nothing wrong with it, it's still been technically bought and paid for.
Well, Well, no, because you still get to, again, this is where I'm going to tie it into prioritize again.
You get to choose. I know. I understand. You get to choose who you vote for. But if you're bombarded daily with billboards of this one candidate, he's the best. He's the best. He's the best.
But it's actually a neutralized thing, because for the Koch brothers on one side, you have George Soros on the other. It's all the same. There are just as many rich liberals as there are rich conservatives who are putting money into politics. If that was the case, if what Bernie Sanders suggests is true, then there would be no Democrats in office. Barack Obama would not have won the presidency twice. It's pure nonsense. Or is he suggesting that the president of the United States had his election bought by people?
That's what he's suggesting, yes.
Why is he in politics?
From my understanding,
then how is he the one guy who's not bought and paid for? The one guy above all this? I challenge you, Senator Sanders, come on and discuss this with me.
Did he ever actually say that he wasn't bought and paid for? I mean, he just might be saying that the whole system...
Then if he's bought and paid for, then he has no... That doesn't make any sense to me. Because he's complaining about everybody else being bought and paid for is a bad thing. So then his presence in the United States Senate is a bad thing by his own admission.
How do we know he's not just saying the emperor has no clothes? How do we know he's not just saying I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore?
He's about as crazy as Peter Finch was in that. He literally is. He could care less about democracy. He wants to implement a Politburo and a Soviet-style communist government here in the United States. But.
Okay.
He really does.
He's left wing, so he's Democrat.
No, he's an independent. He's not a Democrat. He's the Democrats don't want him. He's too nuts.
However, he's liberal.
No, he's not a liberal. No, he's left of liberal. He is in the Joseph Stalin mode.
Okay, socialism is left of liberal, and communism is left of socialism. On the spectrum.
Socialism was a term that the communists came up with.
I know that's what you're saying. I know that's what you're saying.
This is what they say. This is part of their own adjective.
Communism is comrade. We must share everything. Socialism is the government will give you help.
That's how they softened it, so that they could get people on board.
Okay.
It is. It's. Okay. You can read all about it.
Okay. I'll read all about it again. Okay.
Okay. In their own words. These are their own documents where they say.
All right. Send me that.
People aren't buying communism. Let's come up with another. Let's do another thing.
Send me that.
It's the Matryoshkin archive. We can read it.
All right. Send it to me. All right, we're going to take one more break, and then we're going to come back with another story where we can argue. It's not as fun. You know, the arguments aren't the same as when Rick's here, but it's still, you know, it's still, we actually fill a show pretty good when it's just the two of us. So we'll be right back after this final break. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with Jay Amernick, laughing in the background. Before the break, we were talking about the inside perspective, whereby... We were pretty much just arguing whether there's a difference between communism and socialism, which of course there is. However, Jay doesn't think so. So that's the topic for another day, because I'm going to read what he tells me I need to read, and we will have that discussion another time. In the meantime, though, okay, well, I only want to read that phrase where you said specifically that there's a sentence in there that says, people aren't buying communism, let's call it socialism instead. Because the way that I understand it, the way that it's always been presented as socialism was an evolution of communism, and a lot of elements of communism are not in socialism, and socialism is not as far left as communism. Communism is as far left as you get. Socialism is not as far left as you get. However, in the meantime, we've got another story. This is also a story that comes out of Florida. This one's from Tampa, Florida. Underscoring the multiple challenges facing his administration, President Barack Obama consulted with military officials today about the U.S. counterterrorism campaign against Islamic State militants, just a day after boosting the U.S. response to the Ebola breakout in West Africa. Obama met with top officers at U.S. Central Command in Tampa, which oversees U.S. military efforts in the Middle East. With him were National Security Advisor Susan Rice and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Obama was to address the Central Command troops, providing him another opportunity to make a case for the airstrike campaign that he wants to carry out against Islamic State. Obama was spending 2 days away from Washington, conveniently when Rick is there, to meet with the generals and the scientists charged with carrying out missions against two distinct national security threats, both of which are costing lives and threatening regional stability. He then returns to Washington for a meeting tomorrow with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, drawing attention to the ongoing tensions with Russia. So, in three high-profile days, Obama is seeking to display resolve amid lingering questions about how quickly he has responded to crises and whether his deliberate approach has allowed military, diplomatic, and public health hotspots to flare up. His meeting with U.S. top commanders comes amid newly raised doubts about the ability of the United States to rely on Iraqi forces, Kurds, and Syrian opposition fighters to carry out a ground fight against the Islamic State militants, and whether U.S. troops might have to play a combat role. It also comes as Congress prepared to vote on Obama's request for authority to equip and train Syrian opposition fighters that the administration deems as moderates in the Syrian civil war. Lawmakers in both parties have raised worries that the U.S. might be unable to find enough Syrian rebels who could be trusted to confront the Islamic State, or that their numbers would be sufficient against the extremists. So yesterday, Obama announced the deployment of 3,000 U.S. troops to West Africa to help contain the Ebola outbreak that has already cost at least 2,400 lives and threatens to spread exponentially in the region. While one is distinctly military and the other medical, Obama's challenges in the Middle East and Africa bear some similarities. In both instances, he's been accused of being slow to recognize the threat, and now he's responding with ramped-up efforts. He also has been pressured to offer reassurances that the primary terrorist and health threats rest abroad and that risks to the United States are low. In both cases, he has issued a call for international action, warning that the threat of regional instability could spread. To confront the Islamic State militants, Obama has said he's relying on the U.S.'s military, its diplomats, and its allies. Confronting Ebola yesterday, he had his national security team alongside top officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. So there you go. That's our second story of the day.
Wow, that's quite a basket of different pieces. Yeah. So a couple things. It's good to see the president out in front of this issue. I thought when he first came out, I was a little bit nonplussed actually at his response, which was sort of, I have this thing with political correctness, and you know, we never said the Nazis weren't German, we never said the Soviets weren't Russian. I don't know what the big deal is. This is a little bit more murky, a little bit more complicated, and we don't want to, you know, come across as Islamophobic or anything like that. But I don't know why, you know, the president had to spend so much time trying to define who ISIS is, you know, as opposed to saying this is what they're doing when they're beheading our journalists, when they're you know, raping and killing women. I think the U.S. needs to step up and say, you know, we don't care who you are, we got their back, and he's finally looking to do that, he's always been a little bit reluctant to speak strongly on these issues, which I find curious as well. He initially had said something like, I can't remember exactly what he said, but I was a little shocked. It wasn't saber rattling, and it wasn't really, you know, talking tough. But again, glad to see him out in front of, finally.
You think he's always trying to be too diplomatic?
So my criticism of him non-policy, more of a personality thing. I think he's very thin-skinned because I've seen when people criticize him and everything like that, he gets very defensive, and it's he's just very thin-skinned when it comes to that. So I think he's one of these guys that wants everybody to like him, because I think that's always sort of been the case. You know, he's been very charming, and people seem to like him on a personal level. And so now to be in this situation for the first time in his life, really, as president of the United States, because certainly a senator from Illinois is well liked and beloved by his constituency. His constituency is now the American people, which is far more diverse and complicated
There's never going to be a president that everybody likes.
No, of course not.
The very nature of the position is polarizing among the people.
Of course, but he needs to understand that and know that you can't please all the people. You know, it's interesting. You know, when he gets a negative approval rating, you know, the Republicans and the conservatives tend to rejoice, but what they're not reading is a lot of the disapproval is coming from the president's far left base, who think that he's gone too conservative. So it's the best job, and it's I believe it was Abraham Lincoln who referred to it as the glorious burden.
Okay, so whatever he does here, he's going to get criticized. The left is going to say, "Don't go fight." The right is going to say, "Why didn't you fight sooner?"
Yeah, of course. No, you cannot win. And again, that should be your first thing. That should be like the post-it note that the last president leaves the incoming president. Just from 44 to 45, you ain't gonna win.
Yeah.
Enjoy Air Force One.
It seems like the criticism here is that he's being too wishy-washy to take a stance and take action one way or another. And that now he's trying to make up for that by saying, okay, now we're going to do this, 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 and this, but people are saying kind of too little, too late.
Yeah, no, he's done that. He's done that a couple times. And initially everybody sort of chalked it up to, you know, when he first got into like a rookie mistake, not just him, but his entire, you know, administration sort of coming out and speaking too soon and then having to backtrack and then kind of reorganize what the statement was. And he seems to still be doing that, which is, you know, it's not a policy issue. It's a communications issue. And again, these are all very, very new problems for a president. So, a lot of his defenders will say, well, he's been ragged on more than any other president in history. I'm like, well, no, the way we get information now is so instantaneous that you can't compare it to any other president.
I think George W. Bush was ragged on more than any other president in history.
He certainly got his. Yeah, I would suggest that they're close. But again, think about Facebook was not what it was. Twitter was not what it was when President George W. Bush was in office. You just can't compare. It's always going to be escalating. The next guy or woman is going to feel it. It's going to be worse. It's just going to continue to get worse because of the way we get information now.
Yeah. I don't think we even had MySpace when George W. Bush was in.
No, we did. We had Facebook and everything, but it wasn't the same.
In 2001, we did not.
No, but in 2000.
Imagine if there had been Facebook on 9/11.
No, you're right. Right. Absolutely. A completely different situation. You know, this was, we were getting information through email. We were still watching television. Yeah. You know, I was watching TV news to get my information. As a matter of fact, I was switching actually between the networks and cable news to find out what was going on.
Yeah, because they were all slightly ahead of each other. And what they do is watch the other stations and report based on what the other stations are saying too.
Right.
It's like, oh, ABC just said this. Oh, really? Okay, we got to say that now too.
Yeah, the information, as a matter of fact, when I woke up, I was in Los Angeles at the time, you know, woke up, the first tower was already, the second plane had just hit when I woke up. And then there were other reports coming in that there a bomb went off outside the State Department and all these other, and there was another plane flying up the Potomac River. I mean, it was just, the information was just fast, furious, and in the most cases, wrong.
Yeah.
So now something that's wrong can go, as they say, viral. You see it all the time. The president will get misquoted. It'll be taken out of context. And then next thing you know, it's got 1,000 likes and 10,000 comments. So the way we get, there's just no way to measure, you know, what, you know, the criticism that Abraham Lincoln got versus the criticism that President Barack Obama gets. It's just the way we get information is just so different. It's a silly, silly comparison.
And also, as we've talked about before, the way that people deal with this information, like, people now think it's not only accepted but required that they put out their political views and that they put out criticisms of people on social media. It's almost like they think that's what they need to do. And, you know, these are things that we've always been told, oh, don't talk about politics with people, don't talk about sex, money, whatever. But these are the things that people are definitely taking a stand and even alienating friends by saying anyone that believes this is an idiot and blah, blah, blah. Like, it gets really heated. I'm surprised how heated it gets on Facebook.
One of the things that always sort of, and it's a little bit off topic here, but it sort of confuses me, is that I had and Facebook was around when Senator McCain was running against then Senator Obama the first time around. And things were very heated and very ugly. And I had a friend who was a Democrat who called me in tears, saying she was going to get off Facebook because she couldn't take it anymore. She didn't like being called stupid for being liberal, and she didn't like being called an idiot and all these other things. And those were some of the nicer names.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, well, you know, look, if you want to defriend somebody, defriend them, let it go, whatever. You know, and that was funny to me the next time around when President Obama ran against Governor Romney. She was out there calling anybody who votes for Romney is stupid and an idiot, and you're an idiot, and she was doing the same thing. So I find it curious. It's like, so it's like, why would you do what made you so, called me in tears? I mean, literally, yeah. like hysterical.
Yeah.
Why would you do what made you feel so awful? You know.
I will never understand it, but that is human nature.
First of all, to do what they don't like other people doing,
and second of all, to not like in other people what they don't like in themselves.
Okay, so this again goes back to my inside perspective, was that, you know, the people who are complaining about money in politics seem to be complaining about the Koch brothers, but they're not complaining about George Soros. Or yeah. Richard Perry, or, you know, any of these other, you know.
Are you sure? Are you sure they're targeting just the
Koch? I have never heard anybody complain about George Soros's money in politics. Ever.
Okay. Maybe we should research that and see if anyone's
somebody. I'm sure somebody has.
Yeah.
You know, I have no problem with it, even though I disagree with him. I have no problem with the Koch brothers, even though I disagree with them. That's, you know, I mean, you know, again, you have to regulate it at some point. Otherwise, it really gets out of hand.
You know, and I have no problem with people putting forth their political views or their social views or their moralistic views, their religious views, whatever they want to put forward. What I have a problem with is them trashing other people based on not having the same beliefs. That's where I draw the line.
Yeah. Yes, you're actually bringing up a very good point, and that is that when you define yourself and what you believe in by trying to tear somebody else down.
Yeah.
Then, one, it weakens your cause. I see this a lot, actually, with atheists, oddly enough, who, you know, if you want to be an atheist, good for you. But don't say I'm stupid and I have delusional views because I'm not. I don't understand what that does for your cause. Right.
Yeah. By the same token, you'll have. I was going to say Christian, but like any type of religious people saying that atheists are idiots too.
Of course.
So. Yeah.
I don't see it as much, but I see more, you know, a great many, you know, atheists will poke fun at religion.
Yeah. It seems
which I find unusual.
It seems like the only religious group not poking fun at others are the Buddhists. Like, you're never going to have Buddhists sitting
there. There aren't a lot of Buddhist comedians.
Oh, there's actually a comedy. I want to watch it. I think I saw it on Netflix. It was a bunch of different comedians of different religious persuasions that got together for a tour, and one of them was Buddhist. And I forget what it was called, but it's something like the... I think it's the Coexist Comedy Tour.
Okay, that's interesting. All right.
Yeah.
I've never heard like
one's
Buddhist
Jewish,
comedy.
One's Christian. I know.
Never heard Buddhist comedy. It's I don't know if there's potential there. I have no idea, but
I'm certainly curious. Yeah, me too. And people who call themselves spiritual, not religious, are usually not tearing down other people as well. No. It's like, okay, you want to be religious? You want to go to church? Cool. That's cool. Doesn't work for me. Do what you want.
If,
cool.
And I say, if you don't, you want to be an atheist, you want to be agnostic, more power to you. Go for it.
Yeah.
But don't define you. And that would go for Republicans, Democrats as well. Don't define yourself by what you are not.
Yes. Yes. That's a very good point. Yes.
There we go.
In fact, that is a Facebook worthy quote right there. Don't define yourself by what you are not. Jay Amernick.
I don't think somebody much smarter than me said.
You're not going to take credit.
No, they said it much better than I said it, I'm sure. I can't take credit. I mean, that's like sort of the bald, kind of very simple. I'm sure somebody came up, something quite genius that's, wordsmithed a lot better than that.
Okay, well, I like it even in its simplicity. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. So we got told 2 minutes about 2 minutes ago. I'm going to assume that we're pretty close to the end of the show here.
Okay.
So next week, when we come back, we're going to have Rick Raddatz back. He's been in Washington having secret meetings with politicians that he's trying to. Okay. Well, he said, don't mention any names. So they're kind of.
That doesn't make him. All right.
Well, we will remove the veil of secrecy next week, and we will find out exactly who he talked to, what he accomplished, what they said, and so on and so forth. In the meantime, check us out at politicalfixradio.com. I am Heather Vail, and on behalf of myself, Jay Amernick, and the non-present Rick Raddatz, who is traveling through Washington, have a great week, and we'll catch you next week on The Political Fix.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vail Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.